This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America on this edition of the program. Reeling from the largest refugee crisis since World War II, the EU courts Turkey with billions of dollars and promises of visa-free travel, even as Ankara clamps down on press freedoms and academics. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Desperate for relief from the masses of refugees that are jeopardizing the Schengen open border system, fueling the rise of xenophobia and right-wing political parties, and straining the resources of countries on the eastern edge of the 28-member bloc, EU member states are on the verge of finalizing a deal that would reward Turkey with a fresh push on talks over Turkey's eventual membership of the EU, visa-free travel to Europe's Schengen states, and a doubling of financial aid to Turkey promised last year. Apparently, less money is now on the line, and visa-free travel has been linked to several conditions. And a number of EU states have raised concerns about what is on offer to Turkey amid a clampdown by Ankara on academics and journalists. However, Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu was in Brussels to hear the proposal, but has expressed objection to the very idea of bargaining and deal-making tied to the lives of refugees. Amnesty International has criticized the deal and placed a large sign outside the Brussels talks reading, "Don't trade refugees, stop the deal." The plan suggests that for every Syrian refugee sent back to Turkey, another Syrian would be resettled in the EU directly from the refugee camps in Turkey. Since January 2015, 1 million migrants and refugees have entered the EU by boat from Turkey to Greece. More than 132,000 have arrived this year alone. Well, we'll talk with our analysts about the impact the migrant crisis is having on the EU and the EU relationship with Turkey, a longtime aspirant to EU membership. Our two distinguished analysts are Kadir Üstün. He's executive director at the Foundation for Political, Economic and Social Research, also known as SETA, and that's a Turkish think tank based here in Washington. And Nicholas Danforth. He's senior policy analyst in the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and that's a think tank also based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Kadir Üstün, let me begin with you to talk about this EU-Turkey deal, the trade-offs involved. What are your thoughts so far?
As you know, the EU and the broader international community has failed over the past several years to deal with the crisis in Syria, and now they're trying to deal with the migrant crisis that is a result of the Syrian civil war. And in this case, EU is actually approaching this subject in a very security-oriented perspective, and they are doing everything they can to stop the migrant inflows into EU, and they're trying to talk to Turkey to make sure that those who come from Turkey can be returned and perhaps brought back to EU countries through a legal process instead of an illegal process. But at the end of the day, the EU perspective remains a security-oriented one. It's not necessarily a human rights-first approach. Refugees' rights are not necessarily the first priority. In this case, they're in an urgent sort of effort to block this migration flow. And from Turkey's perspective, EU funds will go directly to migrants and it will ease some of the burden on Turkey, but it's not substantially reducing the refugee numbers in Turkey, actually. It is helping financially, but it might also open up Turkey's relationship with the EU and bring it to a better place. And the visa-free travel, as you know, is actually a right of all EU candidate countries already. So Turkey is getting something that it already should have had. And then opening of chapters are blocked by Cyprus. So that's still up in the air. It's not entirely clear if European leaders will be able to convince Cyprus on that front. So how effective it's going to be? Let's not hope too much out of this because it's dealing with the refugee inflows from Turkey into Greece and other European countries. If it blocks Syrian refugees coming from Turkey, they might find other ways to come through to EU. So this deal doesn't deal with that.
Certainly many limitations Let me turn to you, Nicholas Danforth, from the Bipartisan Policy Center, for your reaction to the evolving deal. Some critics or observers would say that we're in a different place now. It's rather ironic. EU normally places many requirements on Turkey, and now Turkey is, in a sense, because of the enormous role it plays in sheltering many refugees and, of course, serving as a platform for refugees from Syria in particular, to go to EU. Now it's the EU saying to Turkey, well, we need you now, and here's lots of money and certain concessions. How do you see this deal evolving?
And that's what's really discouraging about this deal. I think everyone agrees that this refugee crisis is obviously a humanitarian catastrophe and does have real consequences for Europe. Unfortunately, what I think we see with this deal is that Europe's desperation to deal with it, and to deal with it in perhaps the easiest way possible, has resulted in them being on the verge of working out an agreement with Turkey, which may not make life better for refugees and certainly represents an abandonment of European concerns about democracy and human rights within Turkey itself. I think this is a particularly discouraging conclusion to a much longer process as well, since for some time now there's been a hope that Turkey's eventual EU membership would be the culmination of a process by which Turkey would truly become a democratic country and would join Europe as a democratic country. There's a particularly discouraging cynicism on both sides to the fact that it's only now that new chapters are being opened in the EU accession process, in part precisely because both sides realize that the opening of these chapters won't lead to Turkey's EU membership. In a way, this represents a joint victory for people in the European Union who never thought Turkey could become democratic, and Turkish leaders who never wanted their country to become democratic in the first place.
Turning to you, Kadir Ustun, for your reaction and anything you want to add or subtract to this type of characterization by Nicholas Danforth, there is a lot of cynicism here. There's no question that Turkey needs to be lauded for its role in sheltering so many refugees. But at the same time, it looks like because of circumstances internally, they have some leverage over the EU. There are crackdowns on the press, lots of repression vis-a-vis academics, something that normally EU would deplore and ask Turkey, say to Turkey, this is not acceptable for an aspiring EU member. But now they're sort of apparently turning a bit of a blind eye because they certainly need Turkey to stem the tide of the refugees.
Well, EU for a long time kind of forgot about Turkey until the migrant crisis. Let's not assume that they were criticizing Turkey and it was effective and it was bringing Turkey to a more democratic place, and all of a sudden they forgot about all of that. And they continue to criticize Turkey on human rights and democracy issues. It's not. But I think that urgency that they feel that they need to block these migrants coming into Turkey is really the focus right now for the EU. And the EU membership process for Turkey has been stalled for a long time. And it's not because of democracy inside Turkey. It's because leaders in Europe don't see Turkey as part of EU for a long time now. And they express this even now. Merkel says it's an open-ended process. We are not promising anything concrete. And Turkey has been adamant on its pursuit of the EU membership, despite the fact that there's very low public opinion on the side of EU membership. Turkish people are not that hopeful, and Europeans are not that hopeful it will actually ever going to happen. So what's happening in Turkey right now in terms of democracy? We had a peace process ongoing for several years, and that process failed.
Peace process with?
With the PKK, between the state and the PKK. PKK being an armed terrorist organization, there were indirect talks through Öcalan, the imprisoned leader of PKK, that PKK would pull out of Turkey, give up fighting against the Turkish state, and in return for that, there would be concessions on local administrations being strengthened and their non-fighting forces being returned to Turkey, etc. But that process failed, and the PKK saw regional opportunities, and the deal with Turkey didn't seem as sweet. So now there is fighting between the Turkish security forces. PKK, during this peace process, took advantage and built trenches around cities in the southeast, and they've barricaded cities. They wouldn't allow government security forces to enter, etc. So they've used this time to actually stock up more on their arms and recruitment, and they helped the fighting in northern Syria to their Syrian affiliate PYD. So that process was on a collision course, and now that's what we are seeing. And because of that, I think a lot of the restrictions on rights and freedoms in Turkey are coming from a highly securitized environment.
Turning to you, Nicholas Danforth, because Kadir Üstün brings up a very important point, the Kurdish question. We acknowledge that there was a peace process going on, but a number of events occurred such that we've always known that Turkey, and particularly the Erdogan government, is very skeptical about the Kurds' position within Turkey. And now, because of many attacks and the overflow of problems from Syria, you have the suspicion on the part of Turkey that Kurds in Turkey are working hand in glove, perhaps with the Syrian Kurds who are looking to carve out their own autonomous region. And they're, of course, in an alliance with the United States, which becomes very complicated. But let me just say this to Kadir's point. Sure, there are problems with respect to press freedoms and civil liberties in Turkey, that the EU has demanded reforms. But what he's saying, there's a particularly difficult environment right now because of these attacks. We witnessed an attack earlier this week in Ankara, a very devastating attack. Many civilians were killed. Allegations are that a Syrian Kurdish splinter group is responsible. So do these security concerns on the part of Ankara, do they justify this clampdown on press freedoms and other civil liberties for the larger goal of security and stability?
No, certainly not. And unfortunately, I think what you're seeing right now is that the abuses of press freedom, the undemocratic and authoritarian behavior of the Turkish government is not just a response to the worsening security situation, but has actually become and was from the outset one of the prime drivers of the current return to conflict and the violence and instability, which is unfortunately racking Turkey. The story, of course, that the government likes to tell about this is that everything was going great, democracy and press freedom were alive and well in Turkey. And unfortunately, out of nowhere, you had this terrorist threat emerge, and as a result, maybe regrettably, the government has had to do some minor curtailing of civil liberties. Unfortunately, what you see when you actually look back is that since 2007 or 2008, there's been threats to press freedom in Turkey, ongoing evidence of the government's authoritarian behavior, and these were actually instrumental in the breakdown of negotiations with the PKK. Certainly no one is here saying that the PKK is not a violent organization. Certainly no one's here saying it's an easy partner to work with or trying to say they have no responsibility for the breakdown of these talks. But what is really depressing in looking at Turkish politics over the last decade, the AKP, the Turkish government, which originally came to power promising a much more humane, non-militarized solution to Turkey's Kurdish problem, abandoned that approach and has now returned to a fantasy which I think was discredited over two decades of fighting in the 80s and 90s, that this is a problem that can be solved through military force. And to bring the issue of press freedom back to this, what is so discouraging right now is that numerous people within the Turkish government who for the past 10 years have been supporting negotiations with the PKK, have been saying there's no military solution, are now no longer able to say that. There's now no healthy conversation within Turkey about whether the current government's approach to this problem is the right one, whether, as Kadir suggested, this problem is all the PKK's fault, or whether, as many other observers outside of Turkey have pointed out, the government's behavior, the Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan's push for expanded executive powers was what ultimately sabotaged this deal. In order for Turkey to find a peaceful solution to the situation it finds itself in, this is a debate that has to take place within Turkey, and this is a debate that has been silenced because of the crackdowns on press freedom that we've been discussing.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Kadir Üstün, Executive Director at the Foundation for Political, Economic, and Social Research, SETA, and that's a Turkish think tank based here in Washington, and Nicholas Danforth, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Policy Analyst in the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and that's a think tank based here in Washington. We're discussing the trade-off at stake as the European Union increasingly relies on Turkey to help stem the flow of refugees fleeing conflicts, especially from Syria. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Italy, Gregorio Dimitri. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. We'll turn you back to you, Kadir Ustun, to talk a bit more about what's going on in Turkey internally with the crackdown on the press and some academics in the name of security and trying to fight particularly terrorist attacks. Why do you think the Turkish government, again, notwithstanding the threats from the PKK and other terrorist groups, why is Ankara so concerned about the threats from the Kurds when ISIL, the so-called Islamic State, is posing perhaps an equal, if not greater, threat?
Well, Carol, let's not, you know, lump Kurds, this category of Kurds, has been used in the media too often. There is an organization called PKK that has been waging war against the Turkish state for a long time. And it's an outgrowth, it's part of what we call Kurdish question in Turkey. And for the Kurdish question, in terms of political freedoms and political rights inside Turkey for everyone, including Kurds, it is a political question. There's no military solution to that. With that perspective, the Turkish state entered into negotiations with the PKK. But PKK remains an armed organization that refuses to disavow violence against Turkey and did not pull out all of its forces as was agreed upon at the beginning of those negotiations. And that process took a long time because inside Turkey we had several political crises such as the Gezi Park incidents and then December 7th events, basically a network of Gulenist judges and prosecutors and police trying to take down the government. During those political crises, the PKK wanted to see if AK Party would survive. So they took longer and they took advantage of the regional opportunities as they saw it inside Syria and elsewhere. For Turkey, ISIL has been a threat and Turkey has been waging two wars against both these organizations. But let's not say Turkey is against Kurds because Turkey has great relationship with KRG in northern Iraq, for instance.
Indeed, but very quickly, since we have very few minutes left, what about critics are saying, even the United States, of course, U.S. and Turkey have important relations, very important bilateral partners. Turkey is a member of NATO, but right now, because of the United States' support and alliance with Syrian Kurds in Syria who are helping to combat the threat from Islamic State, but it appears that Turkey is not happy with this arrangement. Yes. And is actually attacking the Syrian Kurds, who are the very allies that the U.S. is working with, presumably would be helping Turkey to fight the ISIL terrorists.
Yes, that's definitely a source of disagreement between the U.S. and Turkey, because the U.S. right now, Obama administration, wants to focus on ISIL only, and they're willing to help whoever is going to confront ISIL. So Obama administration, unfortunately, doesn't have a Syria policy or Kurdish policy. It's focused on ISIL. And there was some sort of understanding between Turkey and U.S., I think. If the Kurds in northern Syria did not threaten Turkey, then Turkey would not act against them. But that's not quite what's happening. PYD is just another affiliate of PKK. And I think the U.S. has been reconsidering this because PYD has been willing to work with Russia, has kicked out Turkmens and Arabs out of that region. They went for ethnic cleansing of sorts, which was criticized by human rights organizations. So they're after their autonomous region in northern Syria. The U.S. and Turkey at the broader policy level are both against that. But the U.S. is willing to help those who will fight ISIS on the ground and is willing to ignore the political goals of that organization at this point.
Turning to you, Nicholas Danforth, for your comment on to what extent the Syrian Kurds declaring, you know, an autonomous region in northern Syria, how that complicates this already very complicated situation between Turkey and the United States.
We'll talk a little bit about the U.S. ISIS Syria side of this, but I think it's really important to go back to this whole question of why peace talks broke down between the government and the PKK. And I think the story that Kadir is telling, this narrative that he's spinning, is actually an excellent example of why freedom of speech in Turkey is such a crucial issue. Because the government has now put out this very sanitized story in which the entire breakdown of negotiations is the PKK's fault. fault. It's simplified a very complicated story into one that justifies the government's current unproductive and ultimately self-defeating war against the PKK by pretending that it had no other choice. And unfortunately, it's now reached the point in Turkey where anyone who disagrees with that narrative, anyone who seeks to point out why the government was responsible for the breakdown in negotiations with the PKK, can actually now be accused of being a terrorist, can be accused of being a PKK sympathizer. And it's this, you know, as I said, we've always been worried about the erosion of freedom of speech in Turkey. But unfortunately, right now, it's getting to the point where it's really metastasizing into what increasingly seems like a paranoid regime that will no longer allow any form of criticism to be publicly aired, particularly in the case of the war against the PKK, as I said, has undermined an ability to challenge the government's narrative. We've seen, you know, within the past couple months of maybe the three major opposition newspapers in Turkey, one of them has been completely seized by the Turkish government and turned into a pro-government mouthpiece. Another one has had its editor arrested, again, on charges of terrorism and plotting a coup in the absence of any evidence of this. The third major independent newspaper has just had its owner indicted for criminal charges that nominally have nothing to do with his newspaper's behavior, but are clearly connected. We've now reached the point where the Turkish government has begun to see all opposition as support for terrorism. It recently actually dispensed with the illusion that this was about freedom of speech and came out and explicitly said that freedom of speech didn't apply to people who it felt were supportive of the PKK. It's now invoked the specter of prosecuting terrorists without guns, which is its idea of any journalists, NGO activists, civil society members who are critical of the Turkish government's position, and the coup attempt that Khadr was alluding to. It's now defined really any opposition to the government, any attempt to bring down the government through legitimate channels as a coup attempt, and is trying to prosecute it accordingly. And unfortunately, I think as long as these policies continue, we're going to see a continuation of a Turkish policy against its domestic Kurdish population, which will spill over and only make the situation in Syria worse.
Well, turning back to you, Kadir Ustunen, I know you most likely very much disagree with what Nicholas is saying, but many objective observers have noted that Turkish journalists already operate under some of the most restrictive media conditions, and now things have certainly deteriorated. But let's move on to one last question, that is the root of the crisis over which now the EU is looking for a solution, and Turkey looks like it can help with the migrant and the refugee crisis. The Syrian civil war, and Turkey has up until today taken very brave and courageous positions in harboring so many refugees and helping the Free Syria Army to defend themselves against the Bashar al-Assad regime. What would Turkey like to see with respect to the resolution of this horrible conflict in which the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad, being additionally supported from Russia, continues to be as bad, if not worse, in terms of attacking its own people, using violence as ISIL? You have two sides of the same coin. What would Turkey like to see? Is it too late for a safe zone, safe havens? What else can the international community do at this point?
I think Turkey is with the international community that seeks a solution for a transitional government to be formed in Syria, etc. But the conditions on the ground are so complicated, a lot of the solutions are not going to fully work. But attention being paid by the international community is better than no attention, which has been the case for a long time. But on the ground, you have a variety of groups with different goals. And Turkey has supported those who were against the Assad regime and wanted to empower them so that they could actually arrive at a political solution. Because if you crush the opposition just like Russia did over the past several months, then a strong side can deliver the ceasefires and other political things that need to be done along the way.
The last word to you, Nicholas Danforth, on this complicated situation in Syria. To what extent maybe the United States or the EU bears some responsibility for this enormous outflow of refugees fleeing mostly the regime of Bashar al-Assad?
You know, I think we've got to a particularly discouraging point when Turkey is actually more optimistic about the possibility of a negotiated settlement to Syria's civil war than to its own civil war. In the United States, certainly everyone watching this thinks that in order to be able to cooperate with Turkey and Syria, in order to be able to bring what is admittedly an incredibly messy and brutal situation in Syria to a peaceful conclusion, this is going to require the Turkish government to take a more productive approach to the situation it finds itself in domestically, and also open up Turkish domestic political space to having an honest discussion about Turkey's policies, foreign and domestic, that will make this kind of conclusion possible.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Kadir Ustun, Executive Director at the Foundation for Political and Economic and Social Research, SETA. That's a Turkish thing. think tank based here in Washington, and Nicholas Danforth, senior policy analyst in the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in, sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you very much.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rashad Smith, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.